The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, in an age of smartphones and streaming, where physical media is disappearing, we'll take a trip to the largest collection of popular music in the world and meet the man who has dedicated most of his life to cataloging records and historic materials. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. In a brightly colored former pig barn in New York's Hudson Valley, there are no longer hogs, but endless rows of cardboard boxes.
So then this is where there are five spaces like this. This is our major collection here and here, and then there's a whole other barn. Do you see why we need more space?
What's in the boxes? Music. Millions of items. Most of them vinyl records. This is the temporary home of the Archive of Contemporary Music, a project that started in New York City in 1985 and moved upstate during the COVID-19 pandemic. It's the largest collection of popular music in the world. The co-founder of the nonprofit Archive is its current executive director, Bob George, who goes by B. For 39 years, the Archive has been cataloging popular music, a project that started when B contributed his collection of 47,000 discs. But B is just one of many people who have lent their music and memorabilia to the Archive. Legendary Rolling Stones guitar player Keith Richards, who serves on the Archive's board of advisors, has shared his collection, including extraordinarily rare blues recordings. For four decades, the project has grown. And grown, and grown, and a more permanent home is now needed. I have visited B at the Archive to learn more.
B. George, founder and director of the Archive of Contemporary Music, and we're here in Stottsburg, New York, in a temporary space called the Piggery on the old Astor Estate, and we're now looking at a wall of about 1,400 signed recordings.
I am looking at Disraeli Gears by Cream. I'm looking at Queen, A Night at the Opera. I'm looking at David Bowie, Hunky Dory, and Patti Smith, Horses. This is quite a collection just even on this wall.
Maya Angelou, when she was a babe, signing Miss Calypso for me. And she was like a hoot. She was like a little bit thicker than she is in that photo and a little bit wobbly. And she held it up and sort of in her shaky hands and said, "My dear, I haven't seen this record in 50 years," in her majestic voice, which is quite wonderful.
Just this wall alone is something to drool over if you're a record nerd. But what can you tell me about this whole space and this archive?
First, I want to tell you that the David Bowie, David signed that for me, and then he decorated it with glitter for me, which was very nice, right?
That's incredible.
So, you know, and it's the first a lobby card signed by Jimi Hendrix's band. So do you remember what lobby cards were when they used to hand them out at shows to get you to come to the next show? So and of themselves, they're quite valuable. That's from an early show at the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit when Hendrix was really first making a first tour of the country. But it's so many wonderful things. John Travolta signed it, a whole bunch of Saturday Night Fevers for us, and so we could auction them off. But probably the rarest one would be this, which is a first pressing, white label copy, British first Rolling Stones record, and it's signed by the whole band, including Brian Jones, okay, which he doesn't sign at all anymore. So it's, and this is our favorite story about Keith Richards. This is slightly obscured or greatly obscured by dog urine, which it was in a pile of newspapers that the dog had been peeing on the corner for about 10 years. So this was found in a house in Boston area that was sinking from the weight of the records. And so we rescued 125,000 records out of that space. And then nice test pressing of Hotel California signed by all of the Eagles. So it's really, really amazing stuff. My first record I got signed, Lolita, when I snuck into a theater in Youngstown, Ohio, and had it signed for me. And I'm not a record collector anymore. I had about 47,000 records and gave them all to the archive. So
B, tell me about how the archive came to be. I understand we're in a temporary space right now, but what are the origins of the whole story here?
Oh, it's a long, strange story. Okay, so that's part of it. I had 47,000 records, and I got them through a series of strange incremental steps, one of which was I had worked with and put out the first record by an artist named Laurie Anderson. So this is the drawing of Oh Superman that Laurie made for the label. And I was also put out experimental recordings. I came to New York in 74 on a scholarship from the Whitney Museum, the Independent Study Program, to be an artist. Laurie and I ended up teaching together another for a group of high school kids, like, you know, capital A art. And then after that, started playing around more with sound. And then I put out a book called Volume, which is the first punk discography. And it's like 700 pages. We can show you. It's called The Bible. It's sort of a major work that everybody sort of emulates in a lot of ways because it was done in its own time. So this is sort of one thing that I've always been interested in, is learning about the music and when it's actually happening as opposed to doing it, you know, like what Harvard starts a hip-hop section in 2007. It's a little late. You know, so we try to do things when it happens. So we have great techno sections. We have all, as music happens, we try to collect it. So I did this. I did Laurie's recording. And then I started working with a DJ in London for the BBC named John Peel. So everywhere I went, people were giving me records because they either wanted to be in the book, they wanted me to produce another record, or they wanted me to play their record on John Peel's show.
So kind of became a point person in a way at a scene when music was really exciting and changing a lot.
Yeah, completely ignored music, I would say. All right.
In a way, back then, but now.
Now, yeah. You put all, well, and then I had all these recordings, and they were basically hip hop, punk, art and experimental, and reggae. Okay? Nobody wanted them. I tried to give them away because that most libraries of the time were focusing on classical, and also, or a little bit ethnic, a little bit American music, and folk music. But nobody wanted this newer stuff at the time. And that's literally everybody. We tried to give it away. And so I had someone come to me with this book and say, why don't we save this stuff? And that's sort of what started it. And it's really funny, too, because the first version, which came out before this one, again, this is 200 some pages. So many people sent me records, the second one becomes 700 pages, right? That's how much stuff was pouring in. But what's really funny is Tim, who's just started working here 3 years ago, he ordered this from me when he was 15.
From you directly. So did you put this in the mail yourself, probably?
Yeah, oh no, we sent him a postcard saying it was sold out and would get him the next one as soon as we could. And he has the postcard, which is so hilarious that it's been, you know, I'm just too old. That's all. It's that simple. But again, so much stuff. I'm going to show you some things that are so remarkable.
I just want to point out, too, is we're looking at a wall, which someone might see if they go to a record store, maybe not everything autographed and signed, but you'd see a wall of the big records, the hits, the rare stuff on the wall, and then you'd see shelves below. And in this, what looks like an old barn, it almost looks like
a
record
store.
A piggery.
Yeah, that's why all the doors.
Off to our left.
Those are the first Sun recordings.
Wow. And below that, just U-Haul boxes.
Yeah. And
I'm guessing have records in
them. Right, they all have records, yes. And again, and those are the first five Elvis singles at the top. We have a lot of things. Johnny Cash had come through at one time when we were in New York City, and he'd signed a lot of his records for us, as did Jerry Lee Lewis. So, yeah, I think we could say that, honestly, most of these records aren't that rare. But they're all in perfect condition, and they're all signed. And that's, I think, something that... I like the idea that the artists signed the records, and that had touched it, and it's something that's important to them.
So you started with 47,000 records.
Yeah, exactly.
How many are in the collection right now?
We think it's a little over 3 million. And it's all, I mean, there's lots of CDs also. It's not just LPs. It's not just vinyl. There's a lot of cassettes. There's a lot of CDs. There's a couple 8-tracks that are quite wonderful. We'll show you some of those. There are a couple cylinders, and then all of our 78s we send off to be digitized with the Internet Archive in San Francisco. They do the Wayback Machine, and they also have digitized our books for us. So if you can go online and read, I think, about 3,000 now of our music books.
When did you have the decision to go from collecting and cataloging to creating an archive of preservation of physical media?
Well, it may sound weird. I'm not really a collector. I don't have any records in my house. They're all here. It was more always about, like you said, the cataloging. And I think that was sort of like what the artwork I was doing. I had done a piece that was in the Whitney Kids had a show at the museum, and it was basically a catalog of lines. So I had just been drawing pencil lines from different pencils, and they put them all in the library card boxes like you would see in an old-fashioned wooden boxes in the library. And it's sort of, that was my interest, was like knowing where things were or what the difference was between different things. Not so much. And then I liked music. So it all sort of came together. And mostly I liked the idea of, like I said, the way, working with Laurie and what was going on at the time. New York was really amazing in the, I guess, from 75 to 77. Nobody who was in the scene was famous. Everybody, there was only one place to eat, Lower Manhattan. You know, it was Dave's Lunch on Broadway and Canal. And that was it. And I lived in an area that later became, we couldn't afford a loft in Soho because it was like $100 a month. So we went to Washington Market, which later became Tribeca. But there were 4 or 5 clubs right there. Then you would go up, so you could hear, like at Tier 3, you could hear experimental music and punk. Then you go uptown to the Bronx or to Harlem and you could hear hip hop. Then you can go to Studio 54 and then to an after hours club like Save the Robot. So it was like a lot of things could happen all at once. And everybody ended up pretty much at Dave's Lunch because there was no other place to go. And nobody had a handler. Nobody had an assistant to keep you away from them. So it was a really interesting time.
It wasn't controlled.
Yeah, by anybody. Nobody knew what was supposed to happen. They were just doing things. And I think that's a little bit different now. Quite a bit different. But let me show you a couple other things. Here's one of our favorites. These are Bone records. So these are from out of Russia, printed on X-ray film.
Is that an elbow?
Yeah. and this is a Howlin' Wolf record.
Wow.
So, because we collect and focus a lot on blues material.
So was this something that was done at the time with Howlin' Wolf in the 50s and 60s?
No. This is something that came out of all the leftover machines from World War II, where people would do recordings at the docks and send it off to their loved ones overseas who were fighting in World War II. So this happened all over Europe and all over America. So all of these machines after the war were just sitting around. They were like lathe cutting recording machines. But in the Soviet Union had banned rock and roll. Therefore, people were bringing in albums and cutting versions that could be sold. And so this is what happened. So somebody had, one guy had a record and he played it to death, and they cut hundreds and hundreds of these. And the most readily available material was X-ray film. So this happened, and so these are called Bone records, and it's quite nice. And we have a couple of these, but this isn't like our favorite. And there's books about it now, and it's really become a big collector's item. I mean, that's part of the problem with all of this, is that things that you love become commodities, and they're for sale, and the price goes up and down. Like Elvis is down, the Misfits are up. You know what I mean? Because of what contributes to the next stage of music, right? So the Beatles are unimportant. Brian Eno is really important, or Bill Nelson. The way things are mixed, the sound of things, takes over from the fame of the artist, or even the quality of an artist.
Not to mention that vinyl record collecting right now is hot.
Right. And it'll disappear again. But it's permanent. I mean, we're prejudiced. We believe that the best way to preserve sound is on a vinyl disc.
Why is that?
Well, CDs have a couple problems. One, they're on metal, so they oxidize. Okay? Two, the players won't be made. And that's the main problem. How are you going to play it when the chips are gone? So anything mechanical has a better chance of surviving, we believe, than something that's electronic or digital. Time will tell. We'll figure it out eventually. That's why we like to work with the Internet Archive, because they're saving the digital version. We're trying to save the physical version. We're not really sure which is best.
Now, B, we are in the piggery now, but this is not the permanent home of the archive, and it hasn't always been here.
Right.
So can you tell me about what's happening and why things are moving around?
Well, we were very lucky to get a very generous donation by Andre Balaz of this space. We thought it would be permanent, but as you see, that's 3 years with a portage on, and we can't get permits to have a water or to have any kind of septic system put in. So we have to relocate. So we're looking, we've been shown very beautiful land up at Bard. We've been shown and talking to people around Beacon, and we're very interested in a property, an old IBM space in Poughkeepsie. So eventually we'll go somewhere, and we might have to go soon if we get evicted, we'll see. But the point is we'd like to stay in Dutchess County, we'd like to stay upstate.
When you're speaking to people about what this is, is there a way for you easily to convey on how important it is to you or how important it is to popular music and physical media?
I hope I'm doing a good job here.
Yeah, but there has to be a sell, right?
Yeah, well, we don't have a product. I mean, we've stayed alive for 39 years without anything to sell. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there is a lot of support. But whether we can get that major support that has, you know, somebody says, you know, we're talking to Quincy Jones's family. We're talking to lots of people about, you know, preserving your legacy, getting something permanent. We want to make that transition from just being an archive and to a more public space. So we're thinking of it being more a center for popular music, where there'd be a listening library, where there'd be a lending library, where there'd be events, where there'd be programming. So all those things that a lot of places do. But we don't want to be, you know, an interactive museum with a fake version of a Van Gogh 50 feet high that you walk into. Do you know what I mean? We don't want to be Disneyland, and we'd like to make the focus on research and on preservation.
You have a vision where somebody can walk in and say, I want to hear a record from the 1960s, 1950s.
Yeah.
Because right now, music is mostly, I think people listen to it on streaming services.
Right.
And they don't have everything.
And they also, you don't know what version you're listening to. I mean, think about it. There's like been 5 or more remasterings of just the Beatles recordings. Okay? And then they're on MP3. Well, maybe we're up to MP7s now. So migration is always the biggest problem. You can't go from one medium to another. And you usually, most universities stop when the grant runs out. So they don't continue on. So every time something is shifted from one medium to another, things are lost. And a different quality is lost. I mean, I find it sometimes hard to listen to a recording on a digital version because things come to the surface in a different way than they did on the original recording, which was often the way the artist wanted it.
Now, do you have playback devices that also match the medium?
Old-fashioned turntables, and, you know, everybody has, like, SL-1200s, you know, those turntables that will ride the waves no matter how bad the recording is. So, yeah, but it's the goal, again, is to have 2 copies of everything. One would be a listening copy, and one would be an archival copy. So the idea of the archival copy could be used for reissues. And that's a lot of the work that we did when we were in Manhattan, especially for Sony, that they would take a sound recording or more even the cover and reproduce it for making a CD or a new version. So it's because an engineer wants to hear the original sometimes and before he does his version on the CD. And also the publishing information is really valuable. Again, the real wealth of the recording industry is in the publishing, not in the artist or the product.
Now, what do you do when you're faced with the challenges of archiving media today that may only be immediately available on streaming services, where it's harder maybe to track down?
Yeah, we don't have a digital librarian yet, and that would be a great, great step forward. And already so much stuff just disappears, right? But luckily, we know enough people, and enough people are giving us collections that we think we're going to get. We don't really have a worry about getting anything in particular. Like, we have no budget at all for acquisitions. Everything is donated, and it's built. And what we do, anybody with a little bit of money could have done. And we've done it with no money. And that's, I think, the real trick to it is all you have to do is want to do it. Any kind of preservation is that way. I mean, look at, we had people wanted to tear down Grand Central, right? And mostly the Kennedys stepped in and said, no, this is ridiculous. Let's raise the money and let's save it. And I think that's always the way it is. There's always going to be people who are going to replace everything. Okay? So if you think some things are of value, you have to fight really hard to save them. I mean, it's just normal. And also things get forgotten. And that's the other thing that people, you know, a good example we'll show you in the Keith Richards collection. We have a Robert Johnson sound recording that from the 1930s until 1962, no one had ever heard a Robert Johnson recording. So you have a long period of time where they're just not available, right? I think the most were 5,000 or some pressed for Terraplane Blues. So the one we have, maybe there were 1,500 done, Me and the Devil Blues. So things disappear for 30 years. It happens all the time. I mean, making a dome disappeared for 1,000 years. How did it make a dome? And they're not even sure how Brunelleschi made the one in Florence, because the Romans did it, and then they forget. Things get forgotten all the time. And it's really hard for any artist to survive for a long time. We encountered, doing our 78s, a woman who, they said, outsold Caruso in the early 1920s, okay? And we thought, oh, well, this is like the grandmother of a famous bluegrass band. I'm trying to remember her name now. See how easy it is to forget? But how could you sell most close to millions of records and no one knows who you are? Archivists don't know. Historians don't know. Things disappear. And so that's the real problem. So
B. George is co-founder and executive director of the Archive of Contemporary Music, which is looking for a permanent home. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Building a school is no easy feat, and is something that can take years and millions of dollars to complete. Recently, work began on a new middle school in Holyoke, Massachusetts, where, in 2015, the underperforming public school district was placed in state receivership. As the state has worked to improve graduation rates and local leaders seek to exit state oversight status, ground was broken on the new state-of-the-art learning facility earlier this month. WAMC's James Polyologopoulos reports.
All right, can
are
you
we shoveling
everyone?
Or are we
yeah,
just
you
standing
will.
Here with shovels?
You will, but not yet.
All right.
City leaders, school committee members, and Holyoke residents gathered at the future home of the district's new middle school, taking part in a groundbreaking ceremony on the grounds of the former William R. Peck Middle School. Before a sign showcasing renderings for the facility, officials like Holyoke Mayor Joshua Garcia shoveled dirt where, just a couple months prior, he and others were cheering as the first pieces of Peck came down. The $85.5 million project was approved back in June 2023, with demolition work on Peck starting soon afterward. Holyoke receiver and superintendent Anthony Soto told the crowd that the project in some form goes back to 2013.
Finally, it's becoming a reality. Today marks a big step forward towards offering a well-designed, well-lit, engaging learning environment for middle school students, about 550 of them.
Built in 1973, the Peck School served as many as 645 students at one point across grades 4 through 8. But according to Holyoke School Committee Vice Chair Aaron Brunel, the facility left a lot to be desired for some time. On its webpage detailing the project, the city went as far as to call the building poorly designed and energy inefficient. Brunel, who has a child in middle school, told WAMC that the presence of asbestos and other materials didn't help anything either.
It was, full of asbestos, lead paint, probably mold. It lacked natural light. Windows didn't function. The school was poorly designed from the beginning. I went to Peck School myself.
The vice chair says after being involved in the city's tours and studies of Peck, bringing down the building took a massive burden off of the city's shoulders. The specific plan to replace Peck, though, didn't come easy. Some 5 years ago, at the recommendation of the Massachusetts School Building Authority, officials moved to have two middle schools built, a proposition Beaudet said the city couldn't afford at the time. The move also required a tax override, which voters soundly rejected during the 2019 municipal elections. Half a decade later, though, with the MSBA reimbursing the city for over $58 million of the $85.5 million project, no override is in the mix. Holyoke City Councilor-at-Large Kevin Jourdain spoke with WAMC at the ceremony.
It's been a lot of work to get us to this point in order to bring a lot of different people together, both financially as well as community energy-wise, to get this and get the ear of the people that we needed to get to with the state in order to give us the proper funding for this school. Luckily, after all that work, we pulled it together.
According to Brunel, the first metal beams for the school are expected to go up in April. Construction is slated to go on for at least a year and a half, with plans to open the school for students in fall 2025. The vice chair added that while signage refers to the project as the William R. Peck Middle School, the city is exploring a potential renaming.
That report from WAMC's James Polyologopoulos. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. If you'd like to tell The Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit WAMCpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1747. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.